This morning, in the first hour of the show, we will return to a subject that certainly we have talked about on and off over the years, and that is the struggle for civil rights here in the United States, but with a slightly different focus, as I think that probably most people, when you talk about that, what they will think about is what happened particularly in the post-war era in the 1960s in the South in the United States. There also was another kind of struggle, and some people might argue, in fact, that it had never really ended, that it's still going in some respects, another kind of struggle that got less attention that took place in the North, particularly around issues of housing and employment. And that is what we will try to focus on here this morning in this hour of the show. Our guest is Thomas Sugrue. He's professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. He is a specialist in 20th century American politics and urban history and race relations. He has authored a number of books, and I just want to mention two, one which I believe was his first, The Origins of the Urban Crisis, was published in 1996 and won the Bancroft Prize in American History, which is a very prestigious prize for writing about history. More recently, he authored The New Suburban History, co-authored that with Kevin Cruz. That was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2006. He's also has been working on a book that will be published sometime soon by Random House, dealing very much with the topic that we will talk about here this morning. That book to be titled Sweet Land of Liberty, The Unfinished Struggle for Racial Equality in the North. He's written for many different scholarly journals, also contributed essays to publications like The Nation, The Washington Post, The Chicago Tribune, The Detroit Free Press. He's done a lot of other things besides teaching. He's served on the boards of the Urban History Association, the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. He's been living now in Philadelphia for a long time. He's also vice chair of the Philadelphia Historical Commission and has been involved in civil rights and urban policy both locally there in Pennsylvania, and also nationally. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk in the MillerCom series about this subject. The title is Jim Crow's Last Stand, The Struggle for Racial Equality in the Suburban North. And that is this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center. These programs are always free and open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend should certainly feel welcome to stop by. It's sponsored by the Department of Landscape Architecture, by the way. And we're also pleased that he could be here and spend a little time with us to talk about the subject. For all of those folks who can't attend the talk, who are far outside of the boundaries of Champaign-Urbana, for people who are listening, also you can participate in the conversation by giving us a call, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can certainly give us a call, and we'd be happy to include you in the conversation. Well, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Just to set up the what I think you've been quoted as saying was the Southern story, the Northern story, that we do have these two different civil rights stories. Just, I suppose, to remind people, when you say the Southern story, I think that's certainly the one that everybody's going to think of. They're going to think about the bus boycott. They're going to think about the various civil rights marches that, and they're going to think about the violence that civil rights activists were met with. All of that. That's that story that we, if people know it at all, that's the story that they know.
Right. I mean, the story that we all grew up with, that we learn in school, that we see in films and in popular culture, is a story of the Southern freedom struggle beginning with the Brown versus Board of Education decision that struck down separate but equal education, or the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. And it's a really compelling story, usually told through the powerful life of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. And it's a story that speaks in some ways to a fundamentally American idea of morality, sin, and redemption. So that the Southern freedom struggle is a story of America being forced by nonviolent activists to confront the system of racial segregation in Jim Crow, and folks nonviolently putting their lives on the line, sometimes becoming martyrs, as King himself did, to bring the gain of racial equality. But this is a story that it's a Southern story. It's a story that leaves out large parts of the United States. The North is treated as the exception. It's the place where civil rights activism didn't need to happen. Or it's the tragic denouement of the civil rights story where, in the conventional wisdom goes, the movement went north. And when it did, it crashed apart on the shoals of black power and identity politics and the urban riots of the late 1960s. But that overlooks the ways that the civil rights struggle actually, in many respects, played out for a much longer period of time, both North and South, but especially in the North, and that the major questions that activists we associate with addressing in the South were actually playing out in northern cities and in northern small towns and northern suburbs well before the 1950s and 1960s. The traditional story of civil rights that we tell is too neat. It's too self-contained, and it lets off the hook a large part of the United States.
I think it seems to me that that's an important point, that what it does, it allows people who outside of the South and the North to say, well, that really wasn't racism, segregation, discrimination. Well, that really wasn't our problem. We didn't have that problem here. The other thing that it strikes me with the way that that story is told is that it contributes to that feeling that some people have, is that somehow the civil rights struggle is over, it's done, they won, and we go on from that, and that then I think lets a lot of people say, well, we really don't have a problem anymore with racism, we don't have a problem with discrimination, the civil rights battle was waged, fought, and won, and so now we go on.
Right. I mean, folks use the term the post-civil rights era to refer to the period after the 1960s. And the assumption behind that term is that this was a battle that was won, that was victorious. And I don't want to diminish the accomplishments of the Southern freedom struggle. The passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 materially changed the lives of African Americans and whites in the South. But to see the civil rights movement as kind of reaching its moment of culmination there overlooks the ways in which racial inequality is still 50 years after the so-called classic phase of the movement in the 50s and 60s, is still in part an unaddressed problem in the United States. And it's one that has some of its most visible manifestations in the North, in the ostensibly liberal, non-Jim Crow, non-official racial segregation region of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you in your research, I know that you have looked at what was happening in some of the big cities in the North, in Philadelphia, in Detroit. Sort of set the stage for this for us. What's the background now for trying to understand what happened there as well?
Well, the African-American migration, the great migration that really begins significantly in the First World War, changes the whole terrain of northern cities and smaller towns in the North, too, and turns the question of race into a real fierce battle over neighborhood, over turf, over employment. And those struggles involve both whites and African-Americans. African-Americans coming north with a hope that this is going to be a land of opportunity, a place where they can make inroads into jobs and into neighborhoods and schools that they didn't have access to in the South. And what they found was a much more mixed bag. Many northern states and northern cities, for example, all the way through the 40s and in some places into the 50s and 60s, excluded African Americans from public accommodations, from restaurants, from hotels. This is a story that we associate, of course, with the South and the sit-ins to open up the lunch counters in 1960 in Greensboro and Nashville and so on. But it's a battle that actually played out in the North. Education. Most northern states had laws on the books that forbade separate education of blacks and whites, but there were laws that were almost always honored in the breach, so that if you were to take a road trip circa 1940 through the North, any small to medium-sized town with an African-American population would have a small all-black public school. It was usually called the Lincoln School or named after some other prominent African-American. And you could do a kind of a tour across America visiting the little Lincoln schools. Most of them were small, run-down, overcrowded school buildings. And they became real battlegrounds because African-Americans came to the North not expecting that they were going to find the same, more or less the same structures of educational inequality that had constricted them in the South. Housing was a huge area of battle. African-Americans attempting to cross the invisible lines that separated black and white neighborhoods faced fierce resistance, mobs gathering in front of their houses, protests and pickets, arson and window breaking, just to name a few. And this was mostly in the larger cities that were real magnets for African-American migration, like Detroit or Chicago or Cleveland. Mm-hmm.
And again, just to make sure people understand the time frame we're talking about here, this was really before World War II.
Before and really all the way up until in most parts of the North into the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. These battles were began, you could say, had their inception at the moment of large African-American movement north, but continued and were unresolved into the 60s. So, in Detroit, to take that example, there were cross-burnings and when African-Americans moved into formerly white neighborhoods in the early and mid-1960s. This was not, the 1920s or, when the Klan, for a brief moment, tried to take control of city government and almost succeeded. This is the supposedly liberal moment in the liberal region of the United States, the North, in kind of the peak of the civil rights, or what we consider the civil rights era.
Just to quickly introduce again our guest, we're talking with Thomas Sugrue. He is professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania and has written a lot on history of race in the United States and also of urban history. He has written a lot about 20th century American politics. He's here to talk about this very subject, that is the civil rights struggle in the North. And he'll be giving a talk this afternoon in the MillerCom series at 4 o'clock. So anybody who is here in and around Champaign-Urbana that would like to hear more from him can do that. And here on the show, questions are welcome, 333-9455. You talked about the fact that there are a number of areas in which this struggle was waged. There was had to do with housing, had to do with education, also had to do with jobs and employment issues. Diane, can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, employment was obviously critical to the success of African Americans to migrants coming north. And many of the major industries in the big cities and smaller towns of the north, steel, meatpacking, the auto industry, just to name three, became real battlegrounds for the inclusion of blacks in the workplace. Most of these companies initially had few, if any, black employees. Those black employees that they did have, and this is, say, in the 1920s and 1930s, most of them were confined to the most dangerous or unpleasant jobs. So in the auto industry, for example, blacks were disproportionately concentrated in the foundry, right? The foundry is, hot. It's really brutal work. Or they were in the paint room where they were breathing paint fumes, and it was really unpleasant work. Civil rights activists working with trade unionists, and the alliance was really powerful between the two in many parts of the North in the 1930s and 1940s, began to challenge the exclusion of blacks from large sections of these workplaces. And they did it by putting pressure on employers, but they also did it by marching, by protesting, by picketing. And World War II is a critical moment for that. During the war, there was a huge need for defense workers, and but a lot of exclusion of African Americans, many of whom were coming to these cities like magnets because they knew there were jobs to be had. In 1940, just before the United States entered the war, a group of civil rights activists nationwide put pressure on the Roosevelt administration saying, we want to be included in defense production and in the military. We want to break down the barriers of racial separation, segregation, and the A. Philip Randolph, the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, proposed a march on Washington. He said that 100,000 African Americans would march on the Capitol. Now, we don't think of that as much of anything today. I mean, 100,000 people march in the Capitol all the time. But just at the moment when the United States was entering the Second World War, trying to give the world a sense of national unity, the sight of possibly hundreds or tens of thousands of African Americans marching on the nation's capital would be a real blow to that sense of unity. And African Americans ended up forcing the federal government, forcing the Roosevelt administration to forbid discrimination in defense industries during the Second World War. But that was a fight too. The executive order that Roosevelt signed after the threatened march on Washington to prevent discrimination in defense industry, that executive order was one that wasn't implemented real easily. It required grassroots activists on the ground in factories and in cities around the country putting pressure on the federal agency to ensure that blacks actually got their fair share of what were, good, secure, well-paying, decent jobs during the Second World War that opened up all sorts of avenues for upward mobility afterwards.
Yeah. There was, it's, you talked about the fact that there were important alliances between trade unionists and civil rights activist. At the same time, it strikes me that there a lot of the tension was, in fact, between the same kinds of people, was between African Americans who were looking for equal opportunity and the opportunity to work, and also working class whites who resisted African Americans moving into their neighborhoods, and I'm sure that African Americans moving into their workplaces as well. So it would have been the same, in a sense, factions of the same interest group on the sides of the whites that would either be either want to work with the blacks or say that we don't want to have anything to do with them.
That's right. So in, say, Congress of Industrial Organizations unions, CIO unions, you had some of the most progressive voices for racial equality anywhere in the United States at the time, who were calling for the inclusion of African Americans in all white jobs and bringing them into union offices. But at the same time, in some of those very same unions, you had intense opposition on the part of the rank and file. So during World War II, a number of industries were paralyzed by short-lived hate strikes where one black worker is introduced to an all-white part of a factory and all the white workers stop working and walk out on the job to protest because they don't want to give up the racial privileges, the security of their employment. They don't want to have to be working side by side with African-American workers. So the labor union was at once one of the greatest allies of the civil rights struggle in the North and in the South for that matter. But at the same time, it also threw up all sorts of obstacles and hurdles. And so it cut both ways.
We have a caller here to bring in. Why don't we do that? Someone who is listening in Charleston, not all that far away, on our toll-free line, line 4, right here. Hello.
Yes. I wonder if your guest has spoken yet about Springfield, Illinois. I think in the 1920s was a huge assault on the black neighborhoods there, and people were killed, and I'm not certain of whether the Klan was involved in that. And then, if my memory is correct, after World War II, there was huge riots, race riots in Detroit. The returning white soldiers were wanting their jobs back, and the racism that went along with that. I just wonder if he had covered that subject matter thus far. You know, I mean, the riots around racially oriented goes way back. And the last thing is, does he understand, or maybe he can help me understand, that the living conditions and the opportunities for blacks to this day in these modern times has diminished? And I've heard those stats, but I'm not certain that I had the information right. And thanks, Dave.
Sure.
Bye.
Great. Those are good questions. The North has a long history of racial violence, racial disorders. And Springfield is one. East St. Louis is another. Chicago in 1919 is yet a third. World War II witnessed riots, large-scale and small-scale, in a number of northern cities and in towns around military bases where you had African Americans asserting their right to use public transportation or to use the streets. You had whites resisting. And Detroit in 1943 was, of course, one of the bloodiest of the riots of that era, sparked by clashes in public space between African Americans and whites. So there's a long history of racial violence in the North. I mean, I could go back. I could keep going on for the rest of the half an hour or so I have, giving you more examples. I mean, the draft riots in New York in 1863, and of course the urban uprisings in the 1960s. But also on a daily basis, and this is an important and largely forgotten part of the story, at least in popular consciousness, forgotten part of the story, are the small everyday acts of violence against African Americans. Those who crossed the invisible line, either trying to move into a formerly white neighborhood or even making the mistake of walking or driving through or trying to go to a restaurant or a bar in a white neighborhood. And throughout the 20th century, crossing those invisible lines came with real consequences. It could get you beaten up. It could get you arrested. It could lead to worse. And it's those little everyday, the sum of those little everyday acts of violence that were in some ways just as important in drawing and keeping firm those invisible boundaries of race that divide up our towns and our cities as the big riots that happened in Springfield or East St. Louis or Chicago or Detroit.
Hmm. And if you take a look at conditions for African Americans in the United States and you make some comparisons between, say, where we are now and where we were I don't know, maybe in 1930 or 1940 or 1950, are in fact, have we in fact been moving backwards since that point?
No. There have been significant gains. I don't want to downplay the fact that the civil rights movement, the struggle for racial equality, did have significant accomplishments. In 1960, more than 50% of African Americans in the United States lived beneath the poverty line. The figures now are in the 20s. It's a pretty significant gain. The black middle class was minuscule before the 1960s, and it's significantly larger now. You'll find black students at major universities like my own University of Pennsylvania who, you know, just simply weren't there 40 or 50 years ago. But what's happened, and this is where the story is a story of victory as well as failure, success and loss, is that poverty, living conditions and especially the large central cities that are home to lots of African Americans have remained bad. The story of civil rights and the struggle for racial equality is a story of a road that forks. For some African Americans, there have been significant gains. For others, there's been stasis or even decline in the period since the 1960s. So it's not a one-size-fits-all story of civil rights victories and growing racial equality. We look out sometimes, and I hear this from my students or from audiences, popular audiences I speak to. We hear, you know, things are great. Look at we now have you know, black actors and black celebrities and black corporate executives and you know, a black middle class, blacks living in the suburbs now. Isn't this a sign that we've overcome? And the answer is yes, we have overcome in some arenas, but in many others we haven't. I mean, one need only, you know, spend an hour driving through the west and south sides of Chicago or through large parts of Detroit or through North Philadelphia to see that there are still really deep structural inequalities that the we have not overcome yet despite decades worth of activism.
We are about at our midpoint in this hour of Focus 580, talking with Thomas Agrew. He's professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, has written a lot on 20th century American politics, on urban history and race relations. He is finishing up a book, or is this close to being published?
It is
published,
in the hands of my editor as we speak.
All right. Sometime soon will be published a book really dealing with this very subject that we're talking about here, to be titled Sweet Land of Liberty, The Unfinished Struggle for Racial Equality in the North. Random House?
Yes.
Is going to publish it. And he is also giving a talk on this very subject as part of the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4 on the U of I campus at the Levis Faculty Center. And anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. That's at 4 o'clock on the third floor of Levis. And here on the show, questions are welcome too. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Because, as you have said, because we really know, to the extent that we know very much about the struggle for civil rights, what we know is the struggle in the South and about things that happened in the South. And the leaders of the struggle that we know about, like Dr. King, these were also people who are associated with the Southern story. There must be, I'm sure that there are, important figures that were active in the North that most people now maybe, unless you live in the city where that took place, or this is something that you study, maybe you know these names, but I'm sure that for a lot of people, there are important figures who were involved in the Northern story that will be completely unfamiliar to us.
Yeah. Part of the real fun of writing this project on the North is that many of the figures who are really important, who are influential regionally or nationally, are mostly forgotten. They're known by, you know, a small number of people who came out of those movements, or they're memorialized in a plaque or a portrait in a public school in a particular town. But their stories have mostly slipped out of the popular consciousness. And so part of my project in this book and is to kind of recover the histories of some of these folks to make them well known. And so I've got some very interesting people. My book begins with a woman called Anna Arnold. She becomes Anna Arnold Hegeman, and she grows up in Anoka, Minnesota. It's pretty much an all-white town. She's the first African-American graduate of Hamline College in St. Paul, Minnesota, and she's ambitious. She's really smart, and she wants to become a school teacher. Well, the St. Paul, Minnesota public schools, despite the fact that Minnesota was even recognized back then as being a pretty liberal state, regarding race relations wouldn't hire an African-American teacher to teach white students. This is in the early 1920s. So she goes south, and she teaches in an all-black college in Mississippi for a couple of years, hates it. She's a Minnesotan. She doesn't like Mississippi. It's just there are two different worlds in some ways for her. Mm-hmm. But she begins a journey across the North that would eventually lead her to kind of the center of the civil rights movement and the Great Depression and World War II. And it's one that makes her realize that the North looks a lot more like Mississippi, like Holly Springs, Mississippi, than she had anticipated. So she goes to Springfield, Ohio. We don't think of Springfield, Ohio as being a hotbed of civil rights activism, but it was. In 1922 and 1923, just as she's arriving there, black parents lead a boycott of the city's new all-black public school. The school board is run by a Klansman at the time. And this is a town that has a long tradition of being a bastion of abolitionism in the 19th century. And, it's got a pretty storied history of involvement in civil rights. But she's there at a moment when African-American parents lead a boycott against a segregated school. And those kinds of boycotts, by the way, are happening all over the place in the North in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. One of the most interesting and almost completely unknown stories that I've uncovered in my research. Hegeman then moves. She's ambitious. She's smart. She's working for the Y, which is the YWCA, one of the few somewhat interracial organizations in this period. She goes to Jersey City and then to Harlem. And in Jersey City, she experiences firsthand the difficulties of black laundry workers, women working in these steam laundries. The working conditions are terrible. You get lye on your hands. They're steamy and hot. They get respiratory problems all the time. And she becomes increasingly radicalized by her encounter with the grueling working conditions of African Americans. Then she ends up in Harlem, in the heart of black America at the beginning of the Great Depression. And she sees wrenching poverty, unlike anything that she's seen before, even in Holly Springs, Mississippi. And she becomes an advocate of jobs for African Americans. She joins protests, "Don't Buy Where You Can't Work" protests in Brooklyn and in Harlem that are boycotts of stores and businesses that serve blacks but don't have any black employees. And she gets involved in the March in Washington movement with A. Philip Randolph to challenge segregation in the Second World War. So she's someone who travels across the North and whose life shows me all of the ways in which racial inequality manifested itself in different places in the North and ties into the freedom struggle in so many, interesting and important ways. Her life in some ways is a microcosm of the transformation of civil rights politics between, the early 20th century and the 1950s and 1960s. And her story kind of comes to its conclusion in the 1960s. She's one of the few black women on the stage at the March on Washington in 1963 with Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. She's the only black woman on the organizing committee. She's really incensed that African-American women are excluded from the leadership and from the speakers at the March on Washington. But she's there, 50 years after she begins her odyssey through, the North. She's there at the March on Washington. And there are lots of activists like this whose stories really bridge what we would consider to be the conventional history of the civil rights movement, culminating in the March in Washington, with these unknown but enormously important stories of the struggle for racial equality in the North.
Yeah. We have some other callers here. Let's bring them into the conversation. Next, someone in Atlanta, Illinois, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Very about-time conversation. One thing, however, that's been brought up quite a few times on this program is the fact that there was a lot of towns in central Illinois that forbid after dark black people from living in them, which I find to be a real hypocrisy. And the fact that the little town I grew up in was one of those towns. My wife grew up in a fairly large town where pretty considerable population in Illinois where that was the case. And the hypocrisy was that being in Lincoln Country, we celebrated in school classes the fact that Lincoln had done what he'd done. And yet the towns, even as a child, I looked at this double standard and I thought this was pretty unusual. So my question would be, did this phenomenon enter into your some of your conclusions about your study?
Absolutely. The phenomenon of sundown towns, as they're called, is one that James Loewen has documented in his book called Sundown Towns. And they were most concentrated not in the Deep South, as you know we would expect superficially, but in the deep Midwest, Illinois, Indiana. These were in some ways the kind of the ground zero, the bastion of these little towns that excluded African Americans systematically. But many of the places that we don't necessarily associate with these sundown towns, what Loewen calls sundown suburbs, were also very important. So much of suburban America, the suburbs surrounding Chicago or Detroit or Cleveland or Cincinnati or St. Louis, you know, are overwhelmingly white. And the whiteness of those places is just part of the taken for granted. It's just how things are, people exercising their free choice in the market. But the story of northern suburbanization is a story of systematic efforts through real estate practices, through bank lending practices, through federal policy to keep these places racially homogenous, as well as grassroots actions by whites who challenged, you know, the handful of blacks who tried to cross the municipal boundaries and move into these suburbs. So this is a really important story.
And, you know, these towns that I'm talking about and you're talking about have changed a little bit, but still that I think that stigma still persists today a little bit. You don't see large populations of any minority in some of these towns. So it's kind of carried over, but there is, like you said, in all aspects of society and change, there has been change, and there is change in this situation, but it's not as great as Americans might think it has been.
That's right. We have a self-congratulatory culture that culminates around, you know, the civil rights celebrations, you know, the Martin Luther King Day, you know, talking about all of the major accomplishments that we've made, that we really have come a long way. And, you know, I find this in the classroom. My students say, you know, when I talk about civil rights, gosh, you know, those Southerners, they were bad. They were vicious. They were, you know, card-carrying Klansmen who, you know, resorted to violence. And we're not racists anymore. There's not racism in the United States anymore. We really have overcome as a result of the movement. And I think that's a really problematic way of thinking about both the gains and where we still have to go in terms of civil rights. It's not a finished job.
I sure agree with you, and thanks for the comment.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go next to someone in Champaign. This would be line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, how are you?
Good.
Enjoying the program. I live here in Champaign, so I kind of would like to ask some questions about current things that are going on, just kind of see what your take is. I look in the north end of Champaign, and there are not a lot of prominent black businesses. And there's not a lot of money or finances available to even start to move towards that. But if you go in the south end of our city, there are shopping malls that are coming up and a lot of businesses. So I still see where there's some things that are not equal. And I don't understand, you know, if we don't have businesses, then we can't build up our communities. You see a lot of problems with our kids in school, and you know everybody kind of says it's the black folks' fault because they're not raising their kids. But there's a lot of things that goes on, and I would consider it hidden racism. You can't really talk about it because if you do, you know, if say you at work, people might treat you funny at work, or you know. So I'd say some of those things still exist today. How do we deal with it today? Because I hear what you're talking about, what's happened in the past, but I'm looking at some of these things that are going on today, and it's somewhat frustrating when you see businesses growing in other parts of town, and you wonder, you know, when will we ever get that same opportunity on our side of town? And it does become frustrating sometimes.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. One way of thinking about race and racial inequality in America today is to follow the money. Where's the money? And the story you tell, I don't know this area particularly well, but the story you tell of the African-American section of town not having the degree of investment and business infrastructure that the more white part of town is a very common story. I live in Northwest Philadelphia in a racially integrated neighborhood that has been so since the 1950s. It's an amazing neighborhood. It makes an appearance in my book. But our little business district, which serves the third wealthiest zip code in the entire city of Philadelphia, is really underdeveloped compared to nearby predominantly white neighborhoods. Why? Because investors are cautious, they're conservative, and they see black folks on the street walking and they say, scary, bad investment. And those kinds of economic decisions about where to invest, about where to put our resources, continue to shape inequality in our landscapes in small towns and suburbs and cities right up until the present day. And they're ones that I think, you know, talking about hidden racism is a good way of putting it. They're ones where you can't necessarily folks who are making those investment decisions aren't coming out and saying, I'm not investing there because black folks live there. Right. That's not the language that they use. It's not acceptable in the current political climate to say overt things like that unless you're, you know, in private behind closed doors where you can say whatever you want. So here's a place where we have to think about public policies, you know, targeted investment, for example, or community economic development that that addresses what are still economic inequalities on our, you know, on our landscape.
Okay, one other thing I wanted to ask you: as African Americans, we use certain hair care products and different things of that nature, and it seems as though the Korean community has cornered the market on that, and we can't even buy hair care products unless we buy it from them. So if we open up a store, then they kind of limit us to what we can buy, and it's generally stuff that people don't want, but the other stores that the Koreans own and sell, they get all the quality stuff. So we had a situation where a lady opened up a store that was African-American to sell African-American products, and her business closed down because they wouldn't sell certain products to her because there were two stores in town that were owned by Koreans, and so she ended up closing her store. So you see it all the time, and I'll hang up and continue to listen, but I appreciate the program, and Lisa gave me some ideas.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Shall we go on? I want to talk, unless you want to make a response to it.
Yeah, well, the question of businesses and business ownership has been a long battle in African-American communities. This is part of the story that I'm telling in my book about the North, really going back to the 1930s and 1940s, when you had what you could say is the beginnings of a movement towards economic self-determinism or self-determination or black economic power, as it came to be called in the 1960s. And these were efforts by African Americans to open up black-owned businesses that would be patronized by African Americans. And there are lots of interesting examples. Black cooperatives, for example, during the 1930s and 1940s were attempted in a number of cities, in Chicago and New York in particular. One of the major issues, however, is that it's very difficult for a minority group, especially in metropolitan areas or cities where they're a minority, to be able to attract enough investment and enough business to remain economically viable. And one of the real problems that many African-American businesses faced in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s is that with the proliferation of malls and chains and so on, that African-Americans often began to patronize those businesses. And so one of the real battlegrounds for civil rights activism in the 1960s were efforts to try to get capital to invest in inner cities. And there were lots of interesting experiments, some of which are still successful. For example, in Philadelphia, there's a African-American owned and run shopping mall that was created by the Zion Development Corporation, Reverend Leon Sullivan, another northern figure who becomes internationally famous. He's the guy who does the Sullivan Accords with South Africa. Leon Sullivan in the 1960s gets African-American businesses and white investors together to create what is only a partially successful but still interesting model for trying to bring investment into an inner city that had been pretty much devastated by disinvestment over the previous 30 or 40 years. So there are those efforts. And part of the story of looking at the civil rights movement in the North is to look at where those efforts took root and where they succeeded and where they failed and ask why.
We have about 10 minutes left. I have another call and we'll get right to, but I do want to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 10, 15 minutes. Thomas Segrew is a professor of history and sociology at University of Pennsylvania, a specialist in 20th century American politics and urban history and race relations. He's here visiting the campus to talk about the struggle for civil rights that took place in the North, the less well-known part of this struggle, certainly. It's the subject of a book that he's written and will be coming out sometime soon from Random House. We want to just go on and include at least one more caller here, the person we have holding, someone on a cell phone calling from Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I find the conversation this morning very interesting. I just wanted to relay some background information. I am originally from Philadelphia. My father, at the end of World War II, was looking around to open a business. And he decided to open a service station, which was located in West Philadelphia, 23rd and Ridge, if you're familiar with that section. In order for him really to get into the business, he needed a partner. And being that the community had already pretty much over there was an established black community, he went into business with a gentleman, with a black gentleman. And in about 1946, and he ran that service station with this man. In the 50s, late 50s, the gentleman had passed away, and my family, of course, had moved to the suburbs, and all our neighbors came over and made their condolences calls to my father having lost his partner in business. They were shocked to learn that he had a black partner in this particular business. And after Lou, which is what I called him as a very young child, because I couldn't say the last word, McCallum, died, his wife took over. My father still continued to do business with her. He also opened another service station in North Philly, right on Broad Street, which is fairly north, and I can't, it was abroad in Montgomery, which happened to be next to a black church. And he got along really famously with the minister of the black church. In fact, they never had any problems with break-ins or burglaries either at either station or the church for vandalism, because my father's stations were located next door and they were open 24 hours. The point I'm trying to make is, even during the race riots in the early 60s in Philadelphia, my father's businesses were always open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, no days closed. And as a result of that, during the race riots, because there were so many rioting, that was in West Philly that time, my father was contacted by the man who was on duty that night at the gas station, said, "You better get down here quickly because they have torches and everything, and they're going to torch the gas station, and I don't want to be around here when those tanks explode." Well, my father, being white, also driving a large Cadillac, told my mother, this was after midnight, that he had to go down to the gas station to turn off the tanks. And my mother said, "Oh, you can't do that. You can't do that." Well, you know, of course, he says, "I have to because they may, you know, blow up the gas station." And my father drove down there in this big Cadillac, of course. And at that time, they were stopping all cars and literally, you know, hurting people. But he continued to drive in very slowly, and interestingly enough, when they saw all the riders saw my father's car, they let him go by because they said, "Oh, don't worry about him. He owns the gas station, and he's, you know, his partner is black, so leave him alone." And of course, the police who had surrounded the gas station were more than happy that my father came down and said, "Gosh, you really took a big chance." He says, "Well, the tanks." And the police said, "Yes, we've been hoping to do something about that." And, of course, my father did turn off the tanks, or shut them off, so that in case torches were blown, the tanks would not blow up and cause all kinds of, you know, fire in that area. And again, what I'm trying to make is that, you know, most of my father's employees were always black because, of course, nobody was willing to pump gas, you know, if you had a, you know, mm-hmm. no white person was willing to work in that. That was, you know, below their status. So, right. of course, all the blacks were willing to do that. And my father, of course, many of them did not have stable homes. They often had a drinking problem. He often bailed them out of jail. He often took them to the hospital if they needed.
Well, it sounds like your father was a really interesting guy in terms of his.
He was a very well-respected man in the black community because in North Philadelphia and because he was in West Philadelphia. And the gas stations, unfortunately, are no longer there. The one on Broad Street now is a parking lot for Temple. But the idea is he instilled that attitude into me that I always feel that everybody is equal. And when I worked at Temple, I used to park in four blocks away. And unfortunately, you know, I never had any second thoughts about walking in that area, even though I had long blonde hair and blue eyes and probably stuck out like a sore thumb. I mean, my father never even considered that as being a problem, you know, for me.
Right.
And my
right.
sisters and my mother would have to remind him that, you know, Carol shouldn't be doing that. Can't you do anything? And my father said, she'll be all right. She'll be all right. And that's the same way that I'm living now in central Champaign. And but as you said, my father was ahead of his time.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I've got to kind of cut in on the caller here. I certainly appreciate the story. I don't know if you can generalize at all from a story like that, or that you would have to say something like that might have been an exception.
Yeah, I think as more historians begin to do interviews and do local research, we'll find, you know, interesting stories like the one your caller just told us that are of stories of folks who in one way or another tried to cross over or transgress the, you know, the lines of race and business and neighborhoods and so forth. And those stories are really interesting stories and of black and white folks who cooperated together. And maybe I can move out to a real general point about here and say that actually one of the very interesting stories about the civil rights movement in the North is how heterogeneous it was, that we need to take a look at blacks and whites, at religious activists, at secular activists, at folks on the political left and right, all of whom forged sometimes fleeting, sometimes more enduring coalitions to try to change the status quo. It took more than just people like the caller's father. It took folks acting collectively and collaboratively to try to push change. That, you know, it's social and political change in civil rights is not just the sum of lots of individual actions. We like to think it's that way, but it's actually more than that. It's the result of people collaborating, working through the political process, whether it be protesting or elections, to try to accomplish really significant change.
Yeah. Let's see if we can get one more call here. We'll go to Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm white, and I was an ADC worker in inner city Detroit the last years of the 60s. And I often, ADC was the welfare, aid dependent children. I often ask my clients, many of whom were from the South, how they found the North, because I was well aware that things were not all rosy. And many of them said that they really preferred the South because they knew where they stood, because the discrimination was overt, whereas it was very subtle in the North. And, you know, we pretended to be equal, but we weren't. So I wonder if you would comment on that.
Yeah, one of the things that African-American migrants found to the North, and I've seen this in interviews and newspaper accounts and all sorts of records, is that Northern-style racial segregation was frustrating. At moments, the North seemed like a really wide-open place with extraordinary opportunities for blacks. On the other hand, you might walk into a restaurant and, you know, get ashes served in your salad or not be served at all. Or you might move into what seemed like a pleasant neighborhood and find, you know, your first day there that there are 100 angry whites gathered out in front chanting, you know, demanding that you pick up and leave. And so the workplace in particular was a really tough one, where if you're a black person, you might get a job in a factory. You might have significant work experience and then find, you know, when there's a downturn or a layoff that you go back looking for another job again and there simply aren't opportunities there for you. So it was a capriciousness that the unpredictability of segregation in the North that made many Southern migrants like the folks you were talking to uneasy about the North.
We're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time for this hour. I do want to mention again, however, people in and around Champaign-Urbana, that our guest, Thomas Grew, will be talking on this subject, Jim Crow's Last Stand, The Struggle for Racial Equality in the Suburban North, as part of a MillerCom series. He'll be speaking this afternoon at 4 at the Levis Faculty Center, sponsored by the Department of Landscape Architecture. And these programs are always open to the public, so anybody who is interested, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can stop by and you can hear the talk. Also, you can look for his soon-to-be-published book from Random House on this subject, Sweet Land of Liberty, The Unfinished Struggle for Racial Equality in the North. Do you have any idea when that might be out? Later this year, maybe?
Probably next winter, if everything goes on schedule, which it looks like it's going to.
Okay, very good. Well, I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.